everybody was making some money. He come down and put a new regulation. But you can still beat it if you got the control. That not that many guys involved, but you got to...
That grainy old tape you're hearing is a recording that comes straight from a wiretap that the FBI and local police set up in the early 1970s. It was part of an investigation into La Cosa Nostra, Kansas City's notorious crime syndicate. Recordings like these play a crucial role in giving new digital life to Kansas City's mob history. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking with a former police investigator who's created an app that allows you to stand on a Kansas City street corner and get the mob history of that spot. Gary Jenkins, welcome to Central Standard. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks, Gina. It's good to be here.
We just heard some tape of a mob courier speaking with crime boss Nick Civella. What were they talking about?
That was Carl Thomas. And Carl Thomas was... He was really their man that they owned in the Tropicana Casino in Las Vegas. And he was explaining how you skimmed money from the casino. You know, the first time...
You got to have that control?
You got to have that control. You got to have control of the count room is what he was saying, I believe. You know, they tried weighing the coins and rigging the scales, and then they'd have to take the overage and that they'd hidden and change it for bills, and that was too much trouble. So he figured out if you just got... four or five guys in the count room, you just rake it off. And as he said, you just count down to hundreds, boom, boom, boom. And next thing you got $20,000 in hundreds ready to go.
Today, people who are engaged in this kind of business might assume that someone's listening in on their phone conversations. But, I mean, this is caught on a wiretap. Do you think these guys had any inkling that that might be a possibility that someone's listening in?
Not the way they were talking, not that day. and actually, there's two forms of technical intercepts, as we called them, audio tapes and gathering audio, and one's a bug or hidden microphone, and one is listening in on the telephone. I believe this particular conversation was on a hidden microphone, but you know, it's basically the same. People are more careful with on a telephone than they are in their living room.
Was that a wiretap that you personally helped set?
I doubt it. You know, at the time, this was a huge, big machine, shall we say, on the part of the government. There was about 20 different wires and hidden microphones set up at one time during this time. And they were also set up in other cities all over the Midwest, Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Las Vegas. And my part as a detective at the time was probably sometimes we would run interference. We'd put on a uniform and hang around the outside if they had to break in a place.
Investigators had to break in?
Right. If the FBI had to plant a hidden microphone, you would have to break in the place and hide the microphone. So you'd do that late at night, and we'd always suit up in our uniforms and just cruise around the outside with an FBI radio, walkie-talkie, and the police radio. And if anything happened, then we'd just swoop in as uniformed policemen. And usually people don't argue with uniformed policemen. You kind of control the scene immediately if something happens.
What was it like breaking into the personal spaces of mobsters? That can't have been easy or, frankly, safe.
Well, you take every possible precaution that you can. For example, at the Villa Capri, that was a club at Independence and Prospect. You follow the owner home. You've been watching him for several days, and you know that he closes up at 2:00 in the morning, and he gets in a particular car and he drives home.
But it takes a special kind of person to follow someone like that home.
It does. But mainly you just have to have manpower, and you have to have people who are willing to lay back and not get too close and take a little bit of a risk. If they go around the corner and, you know, if he heads east on Independence Avenue, he's probably going home. So you just get another car about 5 blocks on down the street and wait for him to come by. And then they radio and then they radio another car on down the street. And somebody else will be trailing along behind just in case he makes an unscheduled stop. And you kind of have some idea where he's going. That's really the only way to follow anybody and not be caught.
Did you develop a relationship of some kind with these guys? I mean, did it feel kind of like your life and your fate was bound up with their stories?
That's a great question. That's what I've never been asked that question before. And I never forget we were watching one of these guys. He actually wasn't a made member. He was a, what we call an associate, and he was a professional criminal. And the we knew it was the FBI had a source, and they knew he was going to do a really high end burglary this one night. And they had a wire on him, and they had a bug on him, and we had about probably 15 cars of people all around him. We had a plane up, and we knew who he was going to contact. We had watched him buy a special drill to drill into the safe, and I was on that surveillance myself, and so we're all around him, and I thought, you know, this guy has no idea that he has about 25 law enforcement people that know every move that he makes. It was creepy.
Yeah, you're totally
it was creepy.
Like, your job is to be obsessed with this person.
Exactly, exactly.
Were you able to stop being obsessed with them ever?
I still haven't quit being obsessed with them, apparently.
Yeah, you've just created this app, Gangland Wire?
Yeah, actually, the name, it's Kansas City Mob Tour. For people that want to search for the app in the iTunes or Google Play Store, it's Kansas City Mob Tour.
What inspired you to create it?
You know, it's the, I'm trying to remember the genesis. It's a new technology. I'm really interested, for an older person, I'm really interested in new technology and how you can use that. And how I can use that to educate people. Because I made two apps at the same time, because I've made two documentary films, one about the Gangland Wire, about the mafia in Kansas City, and then was about the Underground Railroad out here along the Western Frontier. And the title of that one is The Western Underground Railroad. But I wanted to use a new technology on how to educate people about history and make it interesting and entertaining. That's a big complaint about history. It's unentertaining. And to me, it's always been entertaining if you know the stories. And I had a lot of people, when I'd give talks about, when I'd show little clips of my movie and I'd give talks about it, people would ask, well, how can we see these sites? And I thought, well, and then...
It's the answer kind of, you walk by them all the time or you drive
right,
by them
right.
all the time?
Right, people drive by them all the time or within a few blocks of it and they don't know it's there. And a friend of mine took Bill Owsley's book, Mobsters in Our Midst, and he wrote down all the places that he wanted to go see him, and he said he and a friend just went out one Saturday night and drove around, and that hit me too, and it's like, well, I could just create an app. Once I figured out how to create an app, I could create an app that would lead you right to these places.
How do the wiretap recordings factor into the digital experience?
Well, I think it, like you get up around the Marlowe House, and that's up north of the river, and I lead you up to that neighborhood, and you can sit, you know, within a half a block or right in front of that house. I think I didn't put the exact address in because I don't know who lives there now, so they don't need to have people coming up knocking on their door. But I get you real close to that house, and you can sit right outside that house practically and listen and kind of, it should stir your imagination, stir the user's imagination to, you know, to visualize and really feel a part of that as you hear those voices floating out of the past, plotting this crime of skimming from Las Vegas casinos and bring it back to Kansas City.
So if you were to say what part of Kansas City, like what are the borders around the sites that you're talking about?
Oh, say 51st Street, 51st and North Flora would be the farthest north. That it's really the only north of the river location I talk about. And the rest of it is primarily down close to downtown in what we call the northeast part and down in Columbus Park, which is what we always call Little Italy, down around 5th and Troost, down where Grosso's is, for example.
So if you are downtown or in Columbus Park, call 816-235-2888 to tell former police investigator Gary Jenkins your location. We'll see what he can tell us about the mob history of the very spot you are calling from. 816-235-2888. We'll get to those calls in just a little bit. Gary, take me to one of your favorite locations and tell me the story of that place.
I guess the Villa Capri, because it was the linchpin of starting this investigation. Anybody that's ever seen the movie Casino knows that you know, that's about skimming from Las Vegas casinos as well as some other kind of soap opera things out there. But it's primarily about skimming from Las Vegas casinos, and that all started at the Villa Capri at Independence and Prospect. In the movie, they show it a hidden microphone in the back of a grocery store, corner grocery store, and they show a guy complaining about I can't remember, complaining about the skim, something about the skim. And in fact, that conversation took place at the Villa Capri. And in fact, it was at a table in the back. And we were, my unit was really kind of part of that because we had driven by that place, had been in that place, I don't know how many times over the last several years, and learned it was kind of mob headquarters late at night. And we'd go in there, and there was one particular banquette and chairs at the back that nobody ever sat in except these top echelon mob guys, Tuffy DeLuna or Cork Savella and Charlie Mortina and people like that. And we'd write their license, dutifully write your license numbers down and report it and go in and say, yeah, they're there. And you do that year in, year out. And it's like, well, why am I doing this? Well, that the reason we did that helped in getting the affidavit approved for a hidden microphone at that, which uncovered the skim. Then they added in, they had an informant, a really top echelon informant that was really trusted. And that informant told the FBI that these guys were having these conversations about murders back there at that table. So you put those two facts together, and you got your affidavit for a hidden microphone. So that I had kind of a personal connection to that one.
When you see the Villa Capri now, I mean, I've driven past that place a gazillion times, and there's something about its appearance. I mean, it does not get updated, you know?
Right.
That appearance moves in one direction, kind of. And often the lights, the letters that are lit up that spell out Villa Capri are not all lit often in the nighttime. And there's something sort of like film noir when it says, especially when it's CRI, which is like a cry in the night or something, Villa Cry. What do you see when you drive past there now? Do you remember those old stories or do you see it in the past or do you see it in the present?
Oh, I probably see it in the past. I probably only think about the past I will see more if I'm driving by something like that. It's like just immediately all those days and nights that I spent on those particular streets driving around that I'll think about.
So much has changed, especially downtown, in the last 10, 15 years. Is the city you see today still a reflection of Kansas City's old mob families and their seedy business, or have the chapters that have been written since then kind of covered it up a little more?
Oh, you know, and my opinion, I guess, for want of a better word, is it's changed so much. It's, you know, going back to the 30s and actually up to the 50s and 60s, we still had a lot of the kind of vestiges of the O-line mob political kind of connection. I know there was like an old judge when I came on the police department, still a sitting circuit court judge, And I found an old picture from back in the late 30s when he was a young judge, and he was sitting with a group of Jackson County politicians, and one was Johnny Lazy and one was Tano Lococo, and those were two of the biggest mob guys out of the 30s, and here was this judge sitting right there. So that was in 1971 or 72, and he retired about that time. So it's like all that O-line kind of, like I said, political, organized crime, Teamsters Union, money, those things have just, they've gone. It's like Las Vegas. It's totally changed. It's so modern. Corporations run everything now. It's just not, doesn't have the kind of the flavor and the same feel as it once did.
Does what happens here stay here? Is it also like Las Vegas in that way?
Oh. Well, Bill Owsley with the FBI once remarked, I thought it was pretty intuitive, that we've never had a really top-level mob turncoat. We've never, the practice omerta, or keeping your mouth shut, is really strong in Kansas City. We had some lower-level guys. You had to really work for it. You had a lower-level guy would tell you something, then you had to go out and work. I and other people have to go out and work to put that story together and verify what that informant was saying. And you never had the top-level guys. And it's probably such a strong, centralized family in Kansas City that and people knew each other. It's a smaller town. People know everybody, each other. And so you just, it is strong in keeping your mouth shut.
Does the history itself feel different when you experience it with digital tools, or is it basically just the same story dusted off for current generations?
I would say it's the same story. It's just it's easier to access. That was my deal, to make it easier to access by younger people too. I think history is important, and you know, those that forget about history may be condemned to repeat it. And so people need to know that if you allow organized criminals and their corruption to get involved with unions and politics, then you know, you get what you pay for in that case. So I want people to remember that.
But in speaking of that, I mean, it's my sense anyway that people kind of romanticize this history. It's got like a black and white movie kind of feel to it, or the way that people romanticize classic cars that maybe don't run that well or something like that. You know what I mean? Do you
Correct.
Think, as a law enforcement person who was involved in the story, do you think we romanticize this? Do you think we forget something about it?
Oh, definitely. Definitely it's romanticized. Just like they still romanticize Jesse James. And they still romanticize Cole Younger and the Younger Boys, and that's what I grew up on, you know. And but yet we also romanticize, you know, Marshall Dillon and Wyatt Earp and the law enforcement people. I think romanticize conflict. We like conflict. We like action. And we romanticize that. And the criminals and the cops are all, you know, two sides of the coin in that era.
Let's talk to Darren, who's calling us from Columbus Park. He's taken us up on our challenge that you'll tell us where you are in downtown or Columbus Park, and we'll see if our guest, Gary Jenkins, can tell you about the mob history of that spot. Darren, thanks for calling 816-235-2888. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I live in Columbus Park, and around the area of 5th and Tracy Avenue, I'm interested what the closest activity would be around that area.
Oh, you know, this is kind of a no-brainer here, Darren. you're right in the middle of it. And you're in the middle of it that goes clear back to the turn of the century, really, the old Black Hand days. But more modern times, I would say 5th and Troost. If you look on the northwest corner of 5th and Troost, right on the corner, there was a restaurant at one time called Wimpy's, and right next door.
It was called Wimpy's?
Wimpy's.
Okay.
And the next
Good name.
Door west on the north side of the street was what we called the Trap, or the Northview Social Club. And that's where all the mob guys hang out. You know, John Gotti had the, I think it was the Ravenite Social Club. If you've ever seen the pictures of all the mob guys standing around out in front smoking cigarettes and cigars and wearing leather coats and Sansevieria slacks and polo shirts and talking, well, this was the place they did that. And Wimpy's was actually, in the 70s, was operated by undercover FBI people. And they were instructed to not approach these guys, just to run your restaurant and keep your mouth shut. And they did. And nobody ever came in and approached them, but they did start coming in, and they did bug some tables. And actually, I've got a little bit of the take from that Mike in my film, Gangland Wire.
Mike,
very, very interesting.
Darren, excuse me, what is your interest in this spot? Do you just happen to be there right now, or is it a bigger interest than that?
Well, I've always been romanticized with history, and specifically mafia, Kansas City, Midwest, growing up in the Midwest outside of Kansas City on a small farm, coming into the city as a kid and seeing all the something about the old buildings just appealed to me. And as I grew older, just more interest. And as an adult, decided to live in Columbus Park and feel right at home. I think there is a element there still, small element of a feeling of community, knowing lots of people, knowing your neighbors, and there's just something about Columbus Park or Little Italy, or AKA the CP nowadays, and it's very romantic just to live down there, walk down the street in the daytime. You know, you got a great sense of old KC. And I did have a question. If you have a feeling that the powers that be in Kansas City respect and would like to preserve the Columbus Park area, or are they aware? I mean, I know that there's some condos and things coming in around, but we sure wouldn't want some big corporation or people coming in and, you know, taking away more of as the buildings start to collapse and get older.
Well, let's hear from Gary Jenkins on this. I mean, the question about the degree of interest that you think the larger city has in this area, in Columbus Park.
I think this is, it's been going on for a long time, is the flight to the suburbs back in the 70s, and that's really what was going on when Marion Trezolo redeveloped the River Key area. This was the first area like that that developed. We now have the Crossroads and the West Bottoms is all, and they've all developed organically, and Columbus Park has developed organically. You know, it changed from Italian. When Italians first came here and they settled close to the city market and they lived in Columbus Park, and if you've been down there, it looks like some city, eastern city, big eastern city. And then on up in the 70s, because Don Bosco was big into immigration and a lot of Catholics came out of Vietnam, Vietnamese started settling there. And it really became kind of a, you know, their family members start settling there and start seeing Vietnamese restaurants and Vietnamese language signs showing up. And so it's always had this flavor of immigrants. And I would imagine that as long as people and now young people like Darren have moved back down there and they like the ambiance of the area, and it is a cool area. I've thought about buying a house down there myself. I think as long as people keep fixing up the old properties and they don't let them run down, nothing will it will continue to grow, because this city seems to like the cool old areas. And like the West Bottoms is a perfect example.
Let's hear from Mike in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How about the area of Strawberry Hill around 4th Street, 4th and Barnett? Is there any mob history with that?
What can you tell Mike about Strawberry Hill, and particularly 4th and Barnett?
You know, Mike, the only thing mob history I have over there was from if you're old enough and been around long enough, was the Red Apple and the Bachelor's Three. And then the Red Apple, a lot of mob guys like to go to the Red Apple, and the guy that owned it, actually, they put a bomb on his car during that time because Cork Zavella was trying to muscle in on his operation and trying to intimidate him. They didn't really want to kill him. They just wanted to scare him. But as far as out in the neighborhood, no, just those two clubs.
So where were they located?
They were about 4th and just 3rd, just north of, Minnesota Avenue, just north of Minnesota Avenue. There's two strip clubs up in there, kind of like the Bada Bing, if you guys know anything about the Sopranos. the Red Apple was like the Bada Bing for a while.
Well, something that interests me about our previous caller's question is this idea that there's a tension between history and maybe progress, or history and change. Do you think that that is a tension, or do you think that history can be preserved through change?
Well, from a historical preservationist idea, and there's a lot of those people in Kansas City that will go in and stop redevelopment. Out in my own neighborhood, we stopped the West Edge. We had a lot of people that did not want the original Van Tuyl project to go up, and they ended up downsizing it to what it is today, and I think they call it the West Edge. And these old areas like this, certainly no mob location that was famous for being a mob location will ever probably supported by historic preservationists, but they do support neighborhoods and to keep that neighborhood intact the way it was, and rather than tearing it down and building new buildings to fix up the old buildings. And I think that's important, but there's always going to be this tension between the people that want to build new buildings and the people and tear down the old ones, and people want to force people to fix up the old buildings. You know, they say never let your building be a historic landmark because it costs too much to keep it up.
From a standpoint of thinking about the app you've created, what about, I think that's an interesting parallel. Like, do you think that stories that don't get updates could become obsolete, like histories that aren't being converted into things like apps?
No, there's no doubt about it. It's just like music. You know, when's the last time you got your CD out? And so if the music wasn't converted to digital, then it's just going to be gone, the same way with history. You've got We have got to keep up with modern technology, otherwise it'll just get lost.
Let's hear from Susie. She's calling us from 5th and Gillis. Hi, Susie.
Hi. I'm just curious about the Gillis Sundries, which is now Happy Gillis.
What do you know? Do you know the spot she's talking about?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I spent many an hour down in that area.
Tell us about those hours.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I can't really take you clear back to the 30s and 40s. My knowledge.
But why not?
Well, you know, I don't know.
It's before your time.
And it didn't. There was nothing famous that really happened there. And so it wasn't like Mob Central. It was that area was a lot of good, hardworking Italian people that were over here trying to earn a living and in kind of a hostile world when you first get here as an immigrant that doesn't speak the language and looks a little different, dresses a little different than the Italians and Irishmen and the Englishmen that were already here running everything. And so they just labored away quietly running their push carts and opening restaurants and doing other kinds of stonemasonry work and things like that. But, you know, more in modern times, that was a liquor store for a long time and a corner store for the neighborhood. I mean, it was the place that you went to buy your sundries and not just liquor, but anything. It was a CVS of its day, shall we say. And all the old neighborhoods had one, you know. Most of them are gone now. Now you got a CVS on every other corner. But back then you had a little corner store ran by a guy who lived in the neighborhood and probably lived upstairs. And so never any real mob things. There was a game that was ran. Bobby Maroon ran a game upstairs couple of days a week. You'd see these guys that were all we knew they liked to play cards and they would show up a couple of days a week, so you'd go by and pick up their license numbers and see who was going to the game
but it didn't go beyond that for those guys.
Didn't really go beyond that.
So a little dabbling in minor crime.
Well, you know, men like to gamble. You can go out to the country clubs today and look back and see the card room and see it going
So people use apps however they want to. That's part of the deal with these things. But if you have any say in the matter, how would you like to be seeing people using the information that's now at their fingertips through your app?
Well, I'd like to see people just like my friend did. Jim Chappell at Chappell's Restaurant is who it was that gave me this idea. He's the one that did it all on his own. To go for an evening's entertainment, you know, go out and go out to eat. Maybe I make suggestions for restaurants over there in the North End and what we call the North End or Little Italy and downtown places that kind of have that Italian ambiance and go eat out and go to these places and watch little clips from my movie that tell you more about that place and stir your imagination about our city that, you know, over in the city, not way out in southern Johnson County. I'm kind of I have to watch my mouth on that for all you Johnson County listeners, but I just love the inner part of the city and because we need to keep a really strong core in this city.
And it's the KC Mob Tour.
Kansas City Mob Tour. Just search for that.
Gary Jenkins, retired police officer and creator of Kansas City Mob Tour, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Jean.
Central Standard is going to take a short break. When we return, our focus will shift to the history of radical politics at KU as told through old-fashioned ephemera like bumper stickers, pamphlets, that kind of thing. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're exploring history, both the digital kind and the old-fashioned kind. For the rest of the show, we're turning our attention to the history of radical politics at KU. The KU libraries have curated an online exhibit celebrating 50 years of radical political literature. Here with us now is the guy who collected all that literature, Laird Wilcox. Good morning.
Good morning.
This exhibit celebrates the 50-year-old Wilcox collection, which you started. What is in it?
Oh, my gosh, it's huge. It would sell a large home that was built on a couple of boxcars. It's a collection I began back in the 60s, and even before, there's some stuff in there from the 50s. And it consists of an awful lot of books and manuscripts and pamphlets, serials and flyers. It's not just bumper stickers. It's not just ephemeral ephemera. It's serious stuff, too. There's an awful lot there's political manuscripts, there's theses and dissertations, there's a huge amount of serious material, and it draws a lot of serious attention. We've had scholars and graduate students come in from Australia and United Kingdom and elsewhere, and it gets a lot of heavy use by some very serious scholars and writers.
Do you remember the first object in the collection that you got your hands on?
I think I probably do. I think it was probably some radical left literature, some Communist Party stuff. I had an aunt and uncle who were active in the Communist Party in the Bay Area back in the 40s and the 50s, and a lot of my sensitization to the whole issue of radicalism and extremism comes from being around them.
You know, the 40s and 50s would have been not the easiest time to be affiliated with the Communist Party in America, the McCarthy era.
Well, they were affected by it, and they probably had reason to fear that because they were deeply involved in the party. And in fact, my uncle registered under the Smith Act. He was a guy who would not leave the Communist Party when it was outlawed. He had to register as a foreign agent. That brought an awful lot of attention on the family. Other people in the family were conservative or moderate and didn't agree with him very much.
What came first, your interest in radical politics or your collecting of political objects? Did you recognize yourself as having a bigger interest when you started holding on to these things?
Oh, yeah. It was something I was sensitized to early. I became very curious about why people were even interested in this. I listened to an awful lot of conversation and conflict, and it just became something that I kind of focused on. And it stayed with me as I was growing up, as we moved around a lot. My father was a construction worker, and we traveled around the country, so I was always in the position of making new friends. And I just met an awful lot of interesting people. I grew up around construction workers and in the construction trades. In fact, I was a union carpenter myself for 20 years, and really understand that milieu. And I understand the working class milieu very well because I was around it so much. So I just kind of followed these things. And when I was 14 years old, I found myself in Port Arthur, Texas, and I joined my first labor union. My father got me a job in a oil refinery as a building laborer, construction laborer. And I had a chance to spend a lot of time with black workers and with people who work with their hands and just on an everyday basis. And I developed a real strong appreciation for the kind of things that concern them. But I was also a little curious about right-wingers as well. And so I began kind of looking around in that area, trying to see what the similarities and differences were. When I was 14, I ran across a book called The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. It's a study of fanaticism and so mass movements and social movements. He was a longshoreman by profession, and he's kind of a working man's philosopher. And he wrote several books over the years, but that was the one that really interested me. And he had a quotation in there that stayed with me all my life. And he says that all forms of dedication, devotion, loyalty, and self-surrender are a desperate clinging to something which may give worth and meaning to our lives. And I think this is generally true about ideological people, about people who get involved in the causes and crusades in our society, who are the believers and the belongers, who are actually trying to kind of sort things out for themselves. Very often, the cause or crusade they're involved with means a whole lot less than what it does for them. It can make them feel good about themselves. It can explain things in a way that leaves them kind of untouched. The things that are happening in the world don't depend upon choices they've made. They depend upon other forces. This can be a comforting idea. Another book I ran across several years later was a book by Robert Linder called The 50-Minute Hour. And in that book, he described as a psychiatrist, and he explained the analysis of a member of the Communist Party and got into the various reasons why he became what he became and why it didn't work for him, why it still left him conflicted and confused. There was also a chapter about a dogmatic anti-Semite, and it went through the same process of trying to understand what was going on with this guy.
Laird, I'm sorry, I've got to jump in because I'm curious about a photo that I saw online of an exhibit you created as a freshman at KU in 1964. Can you tell me about that exhibit? Because as a freshman, that's so young to be already so entrenched in this interest and putting on your own exhibits.
I take it this was an exhibit of extremes literature that appeared at the KU Student Union. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that was an exhibit of part of my collection. And
so you're what, 18?
I would have been actually 19 then. But as I mentioned, this was an interest I had even before that. I was chairman of the Minority Opinions Forum, which was a student group that brought controversial speakers to the campus. And we had a variety of socialists and right-wingers and neo-Nazis and religious people. And it was very well received. The kids were curious and interested in, the kind of the political and freaks and also different ideas. And that collection appeared about the same time as my chairmanship. We were having all these speakers.
What do you think about KU as a place where young people express themselves politically and have expressed themselves politically for a long time?
I think the campus has changed a lot. I think it's a lot more inhibited than it was then. In the 60s, people, I say, there was kind of an existential freedom, and you could talk about anything. There were debates going on and discussions, and I had all these different speakers. That would be very hard to do today. The pressure groups would be out there keeping people from speaking, you know, banning speakers, shutting down campus groups, trying to get people fired if they had views they didn't like. It's a very intolerant place today. So the atmosphere has changed.
We'll get right back to that. We've got to take one last quick break. When we return, we'll hear stories behind some of the posters, photographs, and more in Laird Wilcox's collection, and we'll bring the curator of the KU Libraries exhibit in on the discussion. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute.